It's 12 o'clock, Newfoundland Standard Time. Stay tuned for the Great Eastern with Paul Moss. You are listening to the Broadcasting Corporation of Newfoundland, 520 on the long wave.
Merriest of Christmases, season's greetings of the highest possible order. I love this winter weather. Born on April 1st, 1949, it was either as an 8-month-old at my first Christmas or as a 20-month-old at the first Christmas I knew to be Christmas that first I heard a word and recognized it as a word. The word was stocking. My first thought then, what does stocking mean? My parents cooed in over the cradle, dangling in front of me objects designed for my entertainment. Dolls, colored balls, jingly bells, toys of all manner and description. I remember their ululations as being indecipherable. Until stocking, the Christmas stocking, hung from the mantelpiece with care. What does stocking mean? A bag, a sack, a receptacle, a gauzy, misty, secret, alluring, soft place, scented with the unknown and yet the attractive. But not just stocking. Christmas stocking. As a Christmas stocking, it promised even more. It held delights, brought gifts, tiny playthings for which one did nothing. They just appeared on one day a year. A child's confusion, then, the mystery of presents and Santa Claus and stockings. How those pleasures were magnified for me in later life. A shapely, silky leg slipped into a softly sighing, slightly electric and snug-fitting black-topped fabric that wrapped itself like a friendly lecher around an instep, an ankle, a calf, a thigh. Then strapped in place by the sensuous garter. The garter merely the slightest of hindrances. The occasion for a little lingering. The soft coaxing. The earnestness of male youth. Halloween, make-believe, tricks and treats. What a lovely-looking young girl you are. Theater class, dress-up, boys will be girls. The lipstick, the powder, the undergarments of sin. Ah, yes. What does stocking mean?
Let it be.
Interior, night. The crumbling manager's office of the Cine El Grande, an abandoned movie palace in the busted old heart of Guadalajara. Blue ghosts projected by an ancient television set illuminate the face of a wild man. Eyes lost in the shadow of deep sockets, he pulls another mouthful of tequila from his bottle and draws a blanket tighter against the chill of a Mexican winter night. A Christmas Eve, to be exact. 1986. Something else stirs in the wreckage of the room. It's a small dog, a chihuahua, his shivering ribs poking through his dull coat. If someone coming upon this desperate pair had been told that the mangy dog was the Hispanic world's Lassie, until recently the biggest marquee draw in the Latin American cinema, and that the emaciated dope fiend was one of the most highly touted directors of his time, they would have laughed disbelievingly. But it was true. The chihuahua was Pepito El Grande. The wild man was me. Bored with the rerun of Cantinflas on the tube, Pepito turns listless, accusing eyes towards me. For the first time in our 5-year relationship, he snarls. And then it begins. The bitter yelps and yaps that sting and cut and can never be taken back. I am responsible for the downfall. My insane financing schemes and uncontrollable substance abuse have wasted the wealth and the image of the continent's greatest film star. I cannot hold it in any longer. And what of the prima donna tantrums on the set, delaying productions for weeks, months even? What of the countless paternity suits, the recurrent rabies, the vicious attack on the orphan girl that had to be hushed up at huge expense? Perhaps Pepito El Grande was getting a little old. Perhaps the great star just didn't have it anymore. That hit home. Wounded, he feigned favoring a paw and limped through a crack in the wall into an obscure alleyway behind the derelict building. I threw the bottle against the wall in a rage and immediately regretted the impulsive waste of fairly decent medium-grade booze. I went out to walk off my rage upon the city, past bands of beggars and thieves gathered round glowing dustbins, along empty great boulevards, pierced now and then by the stench of diesel and the fearsome din of a big rig, into the neighborhoods where the working people lived. I found a comedor closing up its doors. The woman of the house relented, and I handed her my last 6 pesos. A steaming bowl of pozole was placed before me by a child who stood back to watch my greedy slurping with curiosity and terror. It was over. I'd squandered the rich holdings of Pepito Co. on dubious expenditures after the death of Coco Cabrera. Then I'd committed the fool's error of taking out a loan with the Gomez Portillo brothers to finance my epic Pepito trilogy. Consumed by visions of multiplying the loan, I'd put half the mob cash into real estate flips and money laundering schemes, then being organized by the governor of the state, and the other half up my nose. The gov fell out of favor with the PRI, and the get-rich-quick rackets went bust. No problem. I had a guaranteed commercial success in the offing with the Guadalajara International Canine Film Festival. I didn't even know how much I owed anymore, but I did know that there was a contract out on my life. Staring into the soup, I saw myself crashing the legendary Gomez Portillo Christmas party, going out with a bit of bravado. I'd jump the back wall, enter through the patio, and guzzle as much bar booze as I could before the bodyguards took me down. Then, anesthetized, I'd watch as my guts were replaced with goodies, and I was hung from the lemon tree, still kicking, so the little mobsters in training could have a real live piñata to play with. I'd heard that was the kind of stuff the Gomez Portillos really got off on. Merry Christmas, boys. I looked up as music wafted into the comedor from a party across the street. It was a posada. Mary and Joseph and their retinue of friends and musicians out on the street in ritual exile, imploring those inside the house to give them refuge from the cold night. From the windows of the humble dwelling, the innkeeper and his guests sang denials until their cold hearts gradually melted at the specter of new life and salvation in trouble. And finally, the doors were thrown open. Fireworks carriages crackled and spun, and the feasting was unleashed. A timid movement brought me back to the table. The child placed before me a packet containing 2 Christmas tamales and scurried back to his mother, who smiled nervously at me from the door to the kitchen. "Thank you," I said. "Thank you," and stumbled away in shock. My feet hurried me back through the streets filled with the strains of 10,000 posadas. I took the broken stairs of the Cine El Grande 2 at a time and flung open the door to the office. Pepito lay there in the light of the black and white TV. He raised his head, turned to meet my eyes, and whimpered. I looked to the torn mattress in the corner and saw through my tears that he'd killed a rat and placed it delicately on the bed. I hugged him and petted him and held him close for warmth. And we sat down together to our gift of a Christmas supper. "I love you, Pepito. This one's for you, wherever you are." The lights, the makeup, the songs, the dance, the social cliques and bemused self-indulgence. These are the aspects of theater that disgust me. In 1970, what did any of us know about theater? The only theater we knew played movies, or Shakespeare. Until we discovered guerrilla theater. That struck the fancy of a bunch of disaffected, disillusioned, self-described revolutionaries. We were not satisfied with anything. We thought theater might be a good way of expressing our hippie socialist ideals, and not a bad way to meet women either. We liked the late nights, the eternal discussions about reality, perception, soul, life and afterlife, the poetry of youth. But the stage set in those days was doing English bedroom farce or unintelligible new Newfoundland plays by imported Englishmen who couldn't write verse. It was all terribly overplayed and totally in the mainstream. Being liberal-minded, dope-addled hippies, we wanted more, or less. So with only a couple of courses in philosophy under our belts, we sallied forth under the guise of the November 3rd Revolutionary Council of Anti-Theatrics, or the N3 RCAT, as we called it. Bill Murphy was one of my buddies who got involved then, looking for free dope and free love. Neither of which, by the way, folks, exists. We wrote and produced several works. Our first was the occupation of the student complex lunch counter and liberation therefrom of several sandwiches as nourishment for soldiers on the cultural march. Reviews were mixed, and all charges were dropped when Dad paid for the lot. A more successful foray into Che territory was our take on The Mummers, a Christmas spectacle that had been foisted on an unsuspecting and culturally barren society as its Christmas tradition. I shouldn't be telling you, really. What's the statute of limitations on stuff like this, I wonder? Shag it now, I've started. The Mummers troupe had been making a fair buck off the guilty conscience of the St. John's middle and upper classes. The Revolutionary Workers' Christmas Panto, we dubbed our exercise. It was Bill's idea, really, but it looked like a natural to us. We posed as the Mummers, visiting some of the city's richest mansions. A few songs, grab some food in a couple of fields, knock back all the wine, beer, and liquor we could, and then, while the homeowners were entranced by King George slaying the dragon, the Turkish knight and Old Balls the horse would find their way upstairs and liberate underwear, sweaters, leather jackets, and jewelry. This was also the beginning of our next foray into the theater world, a fundraiser. With the proceeds from the fenced Christmas loot, we got our hands on some Nicaraguan agricultural futures. No profit was realized on this venture, however. We went on temporary hiatus and consumed most of our investment. Neither theater nor Christmas meant anything to us for a while.
God rest you. comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Now to the Lord sing praises, all you within this place. And with true love and brotherhood, each other now embrace. This holy tide of Christmas is drawing on a face. All tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy.
Smell that? Roasting goose, savory dressing, hot pudding, Christmas fruit cake steeped in dark rum. More than the lights, more than the snow-muted toll of the raffle bell, more than the crush of shoppers, the smells of Christmas cooking take me back. It's a feast day for all, but forgive me for thinking that Yuletide cuisine in the Moth household was special. Special because my maternal Uncle Verno was a cook. Sorry. He was a chef. And he didn't go by Verno, but in accordance with his French passport, Giscard. Giscard malheureusement. Uncle Verno Giscard went overseas with the Newfoundland Regiment in 1941, and finding life as cannon fodder for a bunch of inbred English generals not to his liking, quit the service. Deserted, they say. Rather than return to the fold and face a firing squad, he disappeared into France. He first worked as kitchen help before assuming the identity of a sous-saucier who had perished in a hideous Bernays accident. Giscard quickly became a member of French Gastronomic Society. In 1953, Uncle Giscard began his annual Christmas visits to Newfoundland. He brought with him ingredients so strange that they seemed to me the fixings of some wonderful witch's kit. Truffles, caviar, confit, and the cheese. Roquefort and Pont l'Evêque and Camembert. Camembert! In 1953 St. John's. And he brought wine. Louis Saint-Georges, Gevrey Chambertin, Pichon Lalande, Haut-Brillant. Every bottle a sumptuous Gallic delight. But the wine that I remember was not French, but Portuguese. A port wine. Christmas dinner always concluded with a hunk of Stilton, walnuts, and a bottle of 1908 Taylor's Vintage Port. Uncle Giscard must have possessed a couple of pipes worth of the celebrated glug, for year after year a bottle of that venerable vintage appeared on the table. I was a boy, and serious indulgence was prohibited, but I would be allowed that one crystal glass of the sweet, yet never cloying, ambrosia of Oporto. Its taste? I'll spare you the string of predictable wine talk adjectives. It was delicious. And what did it induce in this young lad? A warmth. A feeling of well-being, of everything being right with the world. It was a sensation I would come to find irresistible until, by the Christmas of 1989, I wouldn't start a day without it. It wasn't vintage port I was drinking that Christmas so many years later, but bourbon. Bourbon to take the edge off the blow I'd given myself for a present, wrapped in clear plastic with nary a bow. I drank and drank and drank. And wept for a bit, fired a few rounds through the ceiling, and then went off looking for more blow. I was having such a good Christmas. Moral, if it feels good, do it, but not to excess. For this Christmas, I can no longer enjoy a glass of port or any rum in my eggnog. And though I can't say that I miss it, I wish I could. I'd like to take this opportunity for my personal wishes to you for the very best of the season. My wish is joined with those of everybody connected with the Great Eastern and the BCN. Enjoy your family, enjoy your time off, enjoy the love and the food and the gifts. Oh, and one special wish. Merry Christmas, Mom.